We feel, therefore we are. Nicholas Humphrey is a theoretical psychologist based in Cambridge who is known for his work on the evolution of human intelligence and consciousness. He studied mountain gorillas with Diane Fossey in Rwanda. He was the first to demonstrate the existence of blind sight after brain damage in monkeys. He proposed the celebrated theory of the social function of intellect, and he is the only scientist ever to edit the literary journal Granter. He has been the recipient of several honours, including the Martin Luther King Memorial Prize, the British Psychological Society's Book Award, the Fendorf Medal, and the Mind and Brain Prize. He has been lecturer in psychology at Oxford, assistant director of the Sub-Department of Animal Behaviour at Cambridge, Senior Research Fellow in Parapsychology at Cambridge, Professor of Psychology at the New School for Social Research, New York, and School Professor at the London School of Economics. He's written many books. His latest, Sentience, The Invention of Consciousness, is available now, and I'm thrilled to say he joins me now. Professor Nicholas Humphrey, a very good morning to you.
Good morning, Susanna.
Let's talk about your book. Can we start with the title of the book? Sentience, the Invention of Consciousness. May I ask you about the word invention?
Yes, I use invention for two reasons. Partly, one is that consciousness is an extraordinary kind of creation of the human mind. In that sense, it's an invention in the way which, you know, you can invent a piece of music or you can invent a painting. But it was also in the past, of course, an invention at a very different level. Consciousness has been created by natural selection in the course of evolution, and I regard it as one of the most extraordinary and brilliant inventions of nature. In fact, I think consciousness should be regarded as the jewel in the crown of natural evolution.
Despite the scholarly topic, it's a very accessible book for anyone with an interest. Why and how did you take this approach?
Well, I've been working on these issues for a long time now. That's part of the story of the book. I go right back to my early days as an undergraduate when I first became fascinated by the question of consciousness. And very soon I was launched onto some experimental work, which was astonishingly revealing. I mean, in fact, it took me by surprise and everyone else around me. I found that a monkey who'd had a visual cortex at the back of her brain removed and had been rendered blind. This was an experiment done by my supervisor at Cambridge, Larry Weisskranz. I found that she, in fact, wasn't blind. I proved that she could see in a very unusual and remarkable way, which is hard to even imagine. She apparently could see without knowing that she could see. And we called this later blind sight, when it was discovered that similar thing can happen in human beings after damage to the back of the brain, the visual cortex. These humans with this condition of blind sight deny that they have any visual sensations. Yet if you ask them to guess, to just take a guess about what they would be seeing if they could see, they get it quite right. They can tell the position of an object, its shape, its color, and so on. What that made me think about deeply was the question of why, if you can see without sensations, as these patients can, and as apparently my monkey could do, then why do we have sensations? And why do sensations have the very special qualities which they do? Visual sensations, as we all know, are a marvelous feature of human life. They seem to be almost magical in the colors, all that qualitative dimensions. And yet, none of those are directly relevant for the business of appreciating what's out there in the world. So we have perception, which is kind of cold. Perception gives us a picture of what's out there in the world. And then we have sensation, which tells us about our own response to the colors and sounds and pains and things arriving at our body's surface. And it's that which has interested me over the next 50 years. I've been trying to work out what sensations are for, why they have the astonishing qualities they do, almost mystical qualities, and crucially, what other animals besides human beings have that kind of experience.
And of course, we're referring to 50 years, but what are some of the insights that you can share with us now about this life's work?
Well, I tried to come up with a theory, an evolutionary theory of how this capacity has come into being. I've tried to reinvent it by going back to the beginning of animal history and asking how an animal which was initially insentient was unable to appreciate things in the way we do. We can assume that was the condition of all animals far back in time. How that was transformed into the kind of experience which we humans experience today. And it's a slow and twisted story which I tell, but I think I've produced a theory which convinces me, and I think others are increasingly coming around to it, that this could indeed be a plausible sequence, evolutionary sequence, by which you can get from the nothingness of blind sight, condition of my monkey, and the condition of a lot of animals, to the kind of amazing experiences which we value today.
And therefore, your definition of consciousness has itself evolved over time. Can you take us through that? I'm thinking phenomenal consciousness that you refer to in comparison to cognitive consciousness.
Yeah, Susanna, that's a very important point, and it's one which a lot of philosophers and psychologists have missed. I think that we need to distinguish sharply between sort of robotic consciousness, low-level consciousness, which simply means having a cognitive system which works by making the subject of it aware of what's in his or her mind. Consciousness basically means just having access to your mental states. But that's not a very difficult system to explain. In fact, we're increasingly giving that kind of capacity to artificial intelligence. And we can assume that many animals far back in history had that before they had the added dimension of what I call phenomenal consciousness, when sensations took on these extra dimensions, which we value so highly. I think that happened relatively late in evolution. And I'm on my own in thinking that. Many philosophers and psychologists want to believe that sentience is all the way back down to the most primitive of animals. And even perhaps beyond that, there are people who think that even plants are sentient. There are people who think that inanimate matter is sentient in some way. I can't make sense of that. I think sentience is a new and remarkable creation of evolution. And we should see it as that and recognize that it isn't widespread in the world. It's very special. It may indeed have only evolved relatively recently, in the last 200 or 300,000 years, sorry, 200 to 300 million years, I should say, limiting it to creatures like mammals and birds, but not to other cold-blooded animals. So I think that when we talk about sentience, we should be prepared to recognize that it's new, unique, and astonishingly special. And we shouldn't devalue it by assuming it's spread thinly across the whole of the animal kingdom and even beyond that.
RNZ National, you're listening to Sunday Morning. I'm Susanna Leiatawa, speaking with theoretical psychologist Nicholas Humphrey about his latest book, Sentience, The Invention of Consciousness. The idea that consciousness has evolved as a tool of social interaction, are you able to speak to that, please?
Well, yes. If consciousness has evolved, and I assume it must have done because I'm an evolutionist, I think complex passages like this can only have come into existence as a result of natural selection, Darwinian natural selection. But selection requires that the capacity being selected is beneficial. It has to make a difference to biological survival so that the genes which underlie it can be passed on to the next generation. That means that if consciousness, phenomenal consciousness in particular, has evolved by natural selection, it must be making a major difference to the lives of creatures like ourselves who benefit from it. And the question then is, what is it doing for us? It's been quite traditional among philosophers to assume that consciousness is a kind of decoration, some kind of rather irrelevant epiphenomenon of our brains, which we shouldn't which we can enjoy, but we don't necessarily need in leading our lives. And in that's led some philosophers to believe that, in fact, we could be surrounded by human beings who, in fact, aren't conscious in the ways that we are, and yet we wouldn't know that they weren't conscious. There could be zombies walking around among us who, in fact, pretend to be conscious but aren't conscious in the ways that we are. I think that's nonsense. The reason I think it's nonsense is that if consciousness has evolved, it must be making an obvious difference to our lives, something which natural selection could get a hold on in order to select it. Now, that leads me to question and what exactly the benefits could be. And it brings me back to some of my other earlier work. A long time ago, I was working with Diane Fossey, the primatologist who worked with gorillas in Central Africa, in Rwanda. And while I was with her and I was working with her gorillas, I began to wonder about what their brains were for. Gorillas have huge brains. They're not as big as humans, but they're very large indeed compared to most other animals living in the forest. And yet, watching these gorillas out there, I couldn't think why they needed these big brains. Life seemed so easy for them. Food was easy to gather. There were no predators. There was nothing much to do except to eat, sleep, and play. So why did they have such big brains? It occurred to me that the reason they need brains is the reason we need brains. And the reason we need such clever brains is in order to solve problems of our social relationships. Even gorillas live in societies which are extraordinarily complex socially. The physical environment, pretty easy to negotiate, but their family life is not. And for that, they need all the brain power they can get. So gorillas need to be psychologists, natural psychologists, I've called them, as of course we humans do. How do you do natural psychology? How do you get inside the minds of another creature like yourself in order to be able to predict and maybe manipulate the behavior of the other person you're interacting with? I think you do it, well, we know we do it, by imagining ourselves in the other person's place. But you can only imagine yourself in another person's place if you know first what it's like to be in your own place, if you know what it's like to be you. So in order for me to know what you're going to do, I need first to know what I would have done in your circumstances. And for that, I need to have a sense of myself, my phenomenal self, of what it's like to be me, which I think is supplied by phenomenal consciousness. Creatures who don't have phenomenal consciousness, frogs, octopuses, lobsters, and so on, don't need it because they don't do psychology. Frogs are not psychologists. Octopuses are not psychologists. Dogs, on the other hand, are, and so are parrots. And the reason that they may very well have followed us in developing phenomenal consciousness precisely in order to acquire that capacity to read other creatures' minds.
When it comes to other creatures' minds, how aware are we? Do you consider that there is a level of awareness that we have around their consciousness that may also still be limited, that we may discover that other creatures are more conscious than than you consider them currently?
Well, I think there are different ways of being conscious, and certainly some animals have sensory capacities which we don't. Bats, for example, can navigate by echolocation, and they're probably sensitive to, and the echoes have a feeling for them, which we're not aware of. So, of course, there are differences between animals, and there are differences between human beings, for that matter. Not all humans have the full range of sensory capacities that typical human beings do, yet they're still conscious. But I doubt very much that there are going to be kinds of consciousness of a totally different kind. You can say, okay, for me to see or to hear or to taste or to smell or to feel pain, those are different dimensions of consciousness, but they're all clearly examples of the same kind of thing. They have the same quality, the same sense of being sort of immaterial qualities which put us in touch with a different dimension of reality. That makes them all part of the same consciousness domain. And I think that all kinds of consciousness in any other animal will turn out to have that particular dimension to it. So I don't think we're going to miss out. I think that the who even discovered that there are totally alien forms of consciousness. Even if we develop consciousness in machines, I think it will have to take the same kind of form as we already know.
That was absolutely my next question. What is your take on the argument of artificial intelligence becoming conscious?
Well, it's a very hot topic, as you know, at the moment, and people are making absurd claims, I think. Even the important philosopher of consciousness, David Chalmers, recently gave a talk in which he said he thinks that ChatGPT-2 is a 10% chance that it's sentient. Well, what's he mean by that? He really hasn't thought it through, and a philosopher ought to know better to talk in those terms. David Chalmers, of course, being an Australian philosopher, maybe he's well known amongst down in the Antipodes, he makes that claim because he hasn't realized that sentience is different from being intelligent. Kind of consciousness which fascinates people, of course, is the ability to solve problems and to show calculating abilities and to have vast memories and so on. Many animals are turning out to have extraordinary capacities in those respects. And of course, artificial intelligence is soon going to exceed us in some of those intellectual abilities. But those have nothing to do with sentience. They have to do simply with being able to manipulate and to take advantage of integrating information in particular ways. But none of that delivers feeling. For animals, or for machines to have the same kind of phenomenal consciousness as we do, to begin to feel as we do, they would need to have the same kind of incentive for doing that. And why would a machine need to feel? I think that the only reasons, again, would be and may soon be, that they need to interact socially with other machines, or for that matter, to interact socially with human beings. If and when a machine needs to be able to understand what it's like to be me or you in order to achieve its own ends, or perhaps to serve the ends which we've designed it for, then it's going to need to have that kind of insight. And the best way to do that would be to give it a similar sort of consciousness as we have, to make it aware at a phenomenal level of what it's like to be itself.
What important breakthroughs in our understanding of consciousness can you see developing in the next decade or two?
I think, well, if I'd tried to make that prediction 25, 30 years ago, I would have said, we'll soon now understand the basis of sentience and phenomenal consciousness. But I'd have been disappointed. I think the work's going very slowly. The brain turns out to be a very difficult mechanism to understand, to get to the bottom of. It's surprising us in all sorts of ways. And so I think we're going to have to wait some time before we really begin to understand how phenomenal consciousness is actually arising from the human brain. It may be that we will have to turn to artificial intelligence to see if we can model the mechanisms of the brain in ways which we have direct access to, because we've built them into the machines. Except I have to say that increasingly, the way artificial intelligence is going, the designers of these machines don't understand how their own machines work. So they design machines like these advanced language models, and they develop extraordinary capacities, but the designers still don't understand exactly how the machines are doing it. So that may not be a route either. It may be a very long time before we can crack the problem of intelligence, of consciousness, either in humans or in artificial humans, artificial intelligence. So we may have been in this strange situation in which we're beginning to actually build conscious mechanisms, and yet we don't know how it is that they're operating.
Is this rise, I'm going to say, in artificial intelligence design activity, has this motivated your book in any way?
My book is not about artificial intelligence, no. It's about animal intelligence, specifically about human intelligence, and then how far we can apply what we know about human consciousness in order to speculate about animal consciousness. At the end of the book, I do raise the question of whether and if and when machines will begin to have the same kind of consciousness, feeling, sentient consciousness as we do. I raise that partly because of the ethical issues which might then arise. One of the most important reasons why we want to be sure about the extent of consciousness in nature is because everyone agrees that we have a moral duty to protect the lives of animals which have feelings of the kind we do, who are phenomenally conscious, sentient in the sense which we are, who experience pain and, for that matter, pleasures and so on, as we ourselves do. We don't have the same moral responsibility to animals who don't. However intelligent a bee may turn out to be, or for that matter, an octopus, if it isn't experiencing what it's like to be itself in the same kind of way that we do, if it doesn't matter so much to itself to have these feelings, then we don't have the same duty towards it. Long ago, the philosopher Immanuel Kant came up with a very good principle for how we should behave to other creatures, including and particularly other human beings. We should always behave to them in a way in which we would like to be treated if we were in their place. Now, if I was in the place of a dog, then I can imagine what the dog would want to be happening to it. I can feel with the dog, enter its mind, and then realize that for the dog to be in pain or to be hungry, or for that matter to be deprived of going for a walk, is going to matter to it in the same kind of way it would to me. If I try to put myself in the place of an octopus, I don't find that. Its mind is going to be relatively empty. It's going to have all sorts of behaviors which I can recognize, but they won't be driven by conscious feelings of the kind which I know. And so that's why I think we need to make this distinction between sentient animals and not. Otherwise, we're going to get lost in a swamp of imaginary feelings. We're going to see sentience everywhere, and we're not going to know which way to turn, nor how we should actually be behaving in relation to the other animals with whom we share this earth. I think it's important, it's politically and ethically and practically, that we begin to, on the basis of scientific or philosophical analysis, which of the kind I've tried to develop in my book, to know where sentience begins and ends. And then at least we will know where we are. We won't have to be floundering around, imagining, you know, that every time we step on a fly, that we're creating doing some terrible moral harm, for example. But we will have to realize that every time we limit impose on the freedoms and restrictions of a cow or a horse or a raven, for that matter, we probably are doing something which is immoral and which we should, to the utmost extent, avoid.
I have one final question that's actually really my question. Do you, after all of these years of work, ever have the sense or the question that there is a consciousness that we as humans sit inside of that's greater than us?
Suzanne, I'm not sure what you mean by it. I can guess what you might mean by it, but I think the answer was...
It's not really loaded. I'm actually thinking, and this is just you and I, just briefly at the end here, because I'll then thank you. But I'm curious, because of the work and the way in which you're speaking, which I'm absolutely enjoying, everything relates to us, right? And our perception of ourselves, and therefore our perception of other things, our understanding of other things, our care, our moral compass. Have you, in the 50 years of your work, ever had a sense that we are contextualized inside, as we are a universe, a complex galaxy, whatever way we want to go? Do you ever have a sense that there is other consciousness that we are inside of or not?
I think there may be some kind of design to the universe which we are part of. I don't reject that entirely, although, of course, I'm a Darwinian and a scientist. I don't think that is a case of consciousness. I think that would be the wrong way to describe it. I think that the universe has goals. There are things which we were part of some kind of destiny, but I don't think any consciousness is involved there any more than, you know, since the Big Bang of the origins of the universe 15 billion years ago, the world has been developing in the most remarkable and brilliant, unimaginably exciting ways, to create out of nothing the galaxies and all the matter in the universe, including perhaps greatest achievement of all, the invention of conscious life on Earth. We may be unique in that respect. I'm not sure conscious life exists anywhere else. So there's been some kind of arrow to this. Things have been getting more beautiful, more complex, more godly in a sense. And I think that we should recognize that. But I don't think this is the same thing as consciousness. I think we should recognize possibility of purpose in the universe without saying that there is purpose, that there's somebody there who's got it in mind to that the world should develop in that direction.
It's been a pleasure speaking with you, Nicholas Humphrey. Thank you very much for your time today.
It's a pleasure, Susanna. Thank you.